Hello, I'm Marlene Saeed. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, limping from one debt crisis to another, Argentina turns to the International Monetary Fund to restructure a $44 billion bailout. But are IMF loans a financial rescue, or do they hurt nations in desperate need? Also this week, the financial institutions accused of fueling the climate crisis. A new report says banks have channeled $1.5 trillion to coal alone since 2019. So will lenders ever quit the industry? And global warming is threatening Nepal's drinking water security. The South Asian country is known for its heavy rainfall, but precipitation is faltering. So how are farmers tackling the thirst for irrigation? Argentina is Latin America's third largest economy. But during the past 70 years, it has endured one financial crisis after another. One of the main problems is it's borrowed too much money to cover its own public spending. That's included loans from the International Monetary Fund, which it hasn't been able to pay back most of the time. But again, it's now looking to tango with the IMF. The government reached an initial agreement with the International Monetary Fund to refinance more than $40 billion in debt last month. The deal aims to revamp a $57 billion loan deal agreed back in 2018, which Argentina cannot repay. And it would give the country at least 4.5 years grace period before starting to pay back its debt. But the government would have to be slowly reducing its fiscal deficit and cutting the central bank's financing of the treasury. But many people in Argentina oppose the deal. They say austerity measures imposed on the country by the IMF have led to increased poverty. Inflation is at over 50%, and many people can't afford to buy even basic goods. The central bank raised borrowing costs to 42.5% more than 2 weeks ago, its second rate hike this year, in an attempt to bring down the cost of living. Teresa Bo reports from Buenos Aires.
It's a culinary hotspot in the central market of Buenos Aires. And people here pride themselves in cooking the best Spanish tortillas in the city. But with the country's inflation rate at 50%, Patricia Rodriguez Real says she has to make an extra effort each month to keep the business going.
Argentina is a disorganized country, but we learn to serve the situation. It's a constant challenge and a learning experience. Our products have very good quality. I don't want to reduce our quality, so what I do is try to sell as much as I can so I gain in quantity and don't have to increase the price as much.
The government has been trying to regulate the rising prices with controls and other economic measures, but it has not succeeded.
Inflation has been a problem for Argentines for decades, and that's why people implement strategies to protect their income. In this market, for example, butchers meet once a month to agree on the price of certain cuts, and they promote those prices in cardboards like this one. The problem, we're told, is that this month the price of beef went up around 7%, so now they have to change these cardboards once again.
José Luis Aduna owns a butcher shop. Since the pandemic, beef consumption has dropped significantly, and he's still trying to recover from the economic impact.
The beef culture in Argentina is huge, with barbecues every weekend. What we see is people not eating as much beef like before, and they are eating pork and chicken instead.
Inflation forces the government to guarantee that salaries and pensions increase to keep up with the constant rise in prices. Protests like this one show it does not always work. Argentina and the International Monetary Fund are in financial talks to negotiate more than $40 billion in debts to target inflation. But economists say the fight to control rising prices won't be easy.
In Argentina, there are several factors that have an impact on inflation. That's why it's so difficult to tackle it. Unless there is an integral plan that attacks all those causes of inflation, it's like a monster with 1,000 heads.
Argentines have gotten used to living with inflation, and many have found ways to survive it. But it's a vicious cycle that has hurt the country's chances of achieving long-lasting economic growth. Teresa Bo, Al Jazeera, Buenos Aires.
To discuss all of this, I'm joined now by Ximena Blanco, Research Director and Head of America's Risk Insights at Verisk Maplecroft. She joins me from Andalusia in Spain. Thank you so much for your time. Now, the principal job of the IMF is to bail out indebted nations. So why are so many people in Argentina against the IMF?
Well, I mean, I think we need to take a historical perspective for that, right? Argentina's nearing 24 agreements with the IMF, and the country is still stuck in, you know, cycles of boom and bust. So there's a lot of concern, you know, lack of trust that an agreement with the IMF will actually deliver the results it's expected to deliver. Now, interestingly, the most recent polls show that a small majority of people, so just over 50%, actually want to reach an agreement. The question comes about what's in the detail of that agreement, and that's where people are a bit more concerned.
OK, we'll talk about the detail in a sec. But what's interesting is the IMF itself has criticised the deal it made with Argentina back in 2018 when Christine Lagarde was the head of that body. What does that tell us?
Well, I mean, let's just put it this way, right? This is the largest lending facility that the IMF has extended to a country, right? Argentina's loan. And so it's not only Argentina's problem. It's about, you know, the IMF's credibility and about the credibility of its due diligence and how it decided to lend. And of course, there's been a lot of criticism about political interest at the time, right? And I think the IMF's own criticism of its self-criticism has to do with that, right? Recognizing that it also had a duty to make sure it was lending to a country that would be able to pay it back eventually.
So in light of all that, what do you make of this current renegotiated deal with the IMF? Is it going to be more palatable to Argentinians?
Well, I mean, this is the problem, right? We don't really have the details quite yet. And what we have seen so far means that pain is on the way. The reality is that pain will be on the way for the Argentine economy, regardless of what happens. An agreement with the IMF could be less painful than the alternative of having no agreement and going into a default in March, which is the alternative that Argentina was looking at, right? Because that would actually mean a currency crisis. It would mean also higher inflation, which the country is already breaking, you know, records on. And it would also mean the economy would go back into a contraction, right, instead of growth. So the agreement with the IMF is needed, right? And politically in the country, it is very controversial. And so the path will be painful. The question now is, what degree of pain will Argentina have to undergo over the coming years? And is it able to cope with that pain socially and politically?
Much of the country's debt burden is inherited from the previous government. Is Argentina's problem political?
Well, I think Argentina's problem is structural, right? Because that debt is inherited from the previous government, which took out debt to pay debt inherited from the government before that. And we can make that chain going back to the 1970s and the last military dictatorship, right? So the main problem for the country is that it implements government policies and not state policies, right? And so structurally, when there's a change in government, there tends to be a sudden change in regulations, in rules, in policies. And we don't see, like we see in other countries in Latin America, particularly, you know, other emerging markets in South America that have overcome that challenge over the past two decades and have decided that certain economic principles are state policies and do not change overnight when there is an election, right? So I think Argentina now has yet again the challenge of overcoming the swings in policy that characterize the country. And if it doesn't do it, then we will probably be talking again in about 2 or 3 years' time about the Argentine restructure with the IMF and private bondholders.
So fundamentally, what you're saying is Argentina is in a financial black hole and has been for a long time. And it doesn't look like borrowing from the IMF is helping solve its problems long term. So what is the real fix?
Well, the real fix would be, for example, if I put it in the terms of a family, right? Argentina spends more than it makes, right? And it does that every year. One of the first things it will need to do is actually start living to its means, right? And to do that, cutting energy subsidies will be the top priority, because 90% of the country's fiscal deficit stems from the government actually subsidizing energy. And this is, you know, it's quite interesting because Argentina is sitting on one of the world's largest gas reserves, yet this year it's importing gas during the summer months. Mind you, we're currently in the summer in the Southern Hemisphere. They're importing gas to be able to generate energy for industry. So come winter and you have a larger deficit in gas, then you're importing more. And this is draining hard currency. These are the structural things that Argentina needs to resolve and resolve them for good, right? And this is not going to be easy. It's going to be painful and it's going to be a regulatory challenge that the administration will have to overcome during the current year.
And do you think the current administration is up to it?
Well, I think the coalition has, very difficult situation at the moment, right? There's infighting within the coalition. So President Fernandez wants to deliver an agreement because the alternative is dire for his administration and his potential re-election bid. But his vice president, Cristina Kirchner, leads a faction of the coalition that is adamant to say publicly that this is any deal with the IMF is a bad deal and that they're not willing to cut on energy subsidies at the rate that the country needs, and that they would like to be able to continue spending on social programs by expanding the monetary base. That's just simply not sustainable. So I'd expect that at some point this year, latest at the beginning of 2023, we will see a breakup of the current ruling coalition in Argentina ahead of next year's general election.
So what happens now to the current deal on the table with the IMF? Will it just go through as it is? And does it matter that the IMF has such a bad reputation with the people of Argentina?
Well, I think there's two parts to that, right? First, it needs to go to Congress. And there it is likely to go through, but as I said, not without significant tensions within the ruling coalition and with the opposition saying that, you know, they're open to looking at the details of the agreement and supporting a sustainable agreement so long as it is supported by the entire ruling coalition. And this is the key factor, because no matter what happens with this deal, this isn't a repayment plan that is going to be resolved in the next 2 years. So whoever is the next government, be it the current coalition or the opposition, they will need to be in agreement that they will maintain the terms of this agreement. The second part is, you know, the country is already experiencing a slowdown of the economic recovery. Argentina's economy is not going to recover to pre-pandemic levels until the latter part of this decade, if it reaches pre-pandemic levels. Then the country's looking at two lost decades back to back at the moment. So for people, you know, the IMF agreement, it's more of a theoretical debate. It has to do a lot with purchasing power, how inflation is hitting them. And that will be the key challenge for the government.
Ximena Blanco, Research Director and Head of America's Risk Insights at Verus Maplecroft. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coal is still considered the worst polluter of all fossil fuels, and getting rid of it is crucial to combating global warming and climate change. But money speaks louder than words, and a new study by 28 non-governmental agencies found that major banks are pouring vast sums of money into the coal industry. It is the first update since the COP26 climate conference was held in Glasgow last year. Ugewald and Reclaim Finance, alongside other NGOs, say financial institutions channeled more than $1.5 trillion to the coal industry between January of 2019 and November of 2021. More than 80% of the funding came from six countries only. They are the US, China, Japan, India, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Barclays and Citigroup are among the top 10 highest lenders to over 1,000 firms involved in the coal supply chain. Bank of China, Bank of America and Japanese firms took all top three spots. The NGOs also say only 12 banks accounted for almost half of the total $363 billion in loans to the coal industry in the same period. Now, 10 of these so-called dirty dozen lenders are members of the UN's Net Zero Banking Alliance, an industry-led initiative committed to aligning their portfolios with net zero emissions by 2050. And the report says underwriting now accounts for the biggest share of funding for coal clients. The process raises investment or capital for companies by issuing bonds or shares on their behalf and selling them to investors. The NGOs also blame investors for keeping fossil fuel projects afloat. They say at least 5,000 companies own combined holdings of more than $1.2 trillion in the coal industry. Campaigners say the research should be considered a benchmark to assess the promises made at COP26. Major coal-dependent nations pledged at the UN talks for the first time to phase down on coal-fired power generations and inefficient subsidies for fossil fuels. The amendment of the PAC terminology to phase down rather than phase out has raised concerns amongst campaigners it would create a loophole to delay climate action. But it's not just coal receiving lots of cash. Europe's biggest banks are pumping money into new oil and gas production despite those pledges to reduce emissions. Analysis by the campaign group ShareAction show that 25 banks have provided more than $33 billion in loans and other financing to at least 50 companies. HSBC put almost $9 billion into new oil and gas in 2021, while Barclays put in at least $4.5 billion. Deutsche Bank loaned almost $6 billion. The fossil fuel giants receiving the funding included ExxonMobil, Shell, BP and Saudi Aramco. Well, the banks have insisted they are committed to working with their customers to achieve a transition towards low-carbon economy. While oil giant ExxonMobil has said that the International Energy Agency and the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change agree that significant investments in oil and gas is still needed through to 2050, even in a net zero scenario. Net zero, of course, refers to a state in which the greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere are balanced by the removal out of the atmosphere. Let's discuss this further with the market strategist and former economist at Citigroup, Mark Fulton, who's also the chair of the Research Council, the carbon tracker and founding partner of Energy Transition Advisors. He joins us from New South Wales in Australia. Thank you for your time, sir. Who are the biggest financiers when it comes to investment in coal and other carbon-intensive fossil fuels?
Well, essentially, I think if we take coal, I think it's important to step up a level and look at the countries involved. And there's a very good piece of work by the Global Energy Monitor, GEM, that points out that really it's the Chinese lead the financing world, followed by the US, in fact, is an important source of financing, followed by Japan, South Korea, India, and indeed Russia is on the list. I'm not sure how long they'll stay on the list. But essentially, those countries are the source countries, China being very critical to that. And I think, again, if you look even higher up behind that, why is that? Where are the planned coal-fired stations still coming? So if we look at what's planned out there in pre-construction, as they call it, there's about 280 gigawatts of coal still planned. And that's on a base of 2,100. So it's 10% of the existing coal field. That's a lot.
So this is coal plants waiting to be financed. Does that mean an increase in funding?
Correct. Well, as I say, what it is coal plants either planned, pre-permitted or permitted, they're called. And essentially some of those are way before finding financing. A lot of them will get cancelled in our view because they just don't make sense. But some are seeking financing at the moment for sure, and there are different stages of that. But I think, again, within the financing, I mentioned those countries, it's important to realise that 70% of financing comes from government-based entities. And state banks are very significant, particularly in Asia and particularly in China. So while it's right to concentrate on potentially funding coming from the private sector and finance markets, you've got to remember a lot of this is coming from governments themselves, and they are cross-funding. Now, a very important announcement came from China at the COP, where they said they would get out of financing coal stations outside of China. That is considered significant and could knock 40 gigawatts off that 280 number. So we'll have to wait and see how it plays out, but that's a useful announcement.
One of the arguments we often hear is that investment in fossil fuels is still needed until countries make that transition to something a bit healthier. Is that true?
Well, look, I mean, I think it depends on your so-called scenario. So I don't want to get too technical, but there are, so we're talking now, let's widen it beyond coal to oil and gas as well, or fossil fuels. And let's talk about the major sort of push in the world, which is to get to a 1.5C outcome and that means net zero by 2050. That's the big focus, and people want to get there in quite a hurry. So they want to look at these scenarios, which essentially mean if you want to do that, no new coal-fired stations at all from today, finish. Or that 280 has to disappear. And no, in fact, no oil and gas exploration. You need to sort of throttle that back immediately. Now, that is the 1.5 world. I work with a group that is commissioned by the UNPRI, and we look at something called the inevitable policy response, and we look at forecasting what we think might happen as well as what would be required to get to 1.5. And we think we can forecast, say, something like 1.8, which is what the IEA thought the COP the outcome of the COP might have been, and we had forecast that before the COP. And in that, we need to start throttling back on coal. Certainly no new coal from 2025 onwards is a very small window, and we would be very careful how much you do. And then on oil and gas, there's a final window here as oil and gas, oil demand peaks, we think, in the next 2 or 3 years. And following that, it's going to rapidly run off. So there's not a lot of room, even on the sort of not on the so stringent 1.5 outcomes. Even at 1.8, there's not that much room for new investment in oil and gas. There's some, but not a lot.
Very interesting to get your thoughts. Mark Fulton, Chair of the Research Council at the Carbon Tracker and founding partner of Energy Transition Advisors. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Water scarcity in Nepal is just one example of how the climate crisis could pose an existential threat. The South Asian nation has one of the heaviest rainfall in the world, but longer dry spells are causing a serious drinking water shortage. Well, now farmers are coming up with simple but effective ways to harvest the rain during monsoon season. Zain Basravi has more from central Nepal.
Nepal has always been one of the rainiest countries in the world, giving it lush, green, rolling foothills, the hallmark of the Himalayas. It's certainly not the kind of place you might think is suffering a water security crisis.
Earlier, there used to be low intensity, long duration rainfall. Now what is happening? High intensity rainfall in short duration, that will not go inside the ground. That will go flow as a runoff. That means you have less storage of groundwater.
It only rains for part of the year, and Nepal's terrain can turn barren quickly. But just outside Kathmandu, routinely ranked as one of the most polluted cities in the world, is a regeneration success story. This thriving forest wasn't here 2 decades ago. Now scientists use it to study how best to collect and keep the most basic element. With rain collection systems like this, one tank can hold enough water for a family of 5 for up to a month. And ponds cut into the sides of steep hills have the power to bring dry wells back to life. In rural villages, applying these designs is saving farms and lives.
At first glance, it looks like any other hillside in this part of Nepal. But what's happening here is local farming communities using simple methods to solve a complex environmental problem.
Earthquakes and man-made roads change the way rain moves downhill. At the mouth of this underground well, Purnaman Lama explains how changes to terrain stopped the flow of groundwater and left this life-giving natural spring totally dry. In rural Nepal, wells like this are the primary source of water for drinking and domestic use.
Building terraced ponds to collect and carefully pipe the water to both crops and homes has saved villagers from uprooting their entire lives.
If there was no water here, we have to go very far and look for other water sources much further away. But we are happy. The water started to come here again. The water is collecting slowly and gradually reviving.
Scientists and farmers in Nepal say the world around them is changing faster than it has to. But roads can't be unbuilt, and there is no taking back the weather-altering greenhouse gases in the air. So all they can do now is their best to adapt to their altered ecosystem. Zain Basravi, Al Jazeera, Bakunde Besi, Nepal.
And that is our show for this week, but I want to know what you think and what you want to see on the show. Tweet or DM me at Marlene Saeed. And if you're tweeting, then please use the hashtag AJCTC. Or if email's more your thing, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. And there's lots more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Marlene Saeed from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.